Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, welcome to the Really 007 podcast for this special episode. We've got a behind-the-camera interview with none other than Katharina Kubrick, who you can see is here with us, as well as her dog, Wendy. So, yes, Katharina's worked on many classic films in many different roles, and we'll be talking about some of those tonight, including several of her fathers, such as Barry Lyndon, The Shining, and Eyes Wide Shut. But, obviously, we're a Bond podcast, and her work on the Bond films is legendary, creating the prosthetic teeth worn by Jaws. And that's going to be interesting to talk about that as well. So you can watch all our other interviews on our YouTube channel, and you can listen to our episodes on iTunes and Spotify and on our website. We're on all social media platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So with me, Tom Pickup, I have other Bond and cinema fan, Chris Goldie. So welcome, Chris, to you as well.
Thank you.
So yes, Katharina. Now, obviously you're from a famous family, but you've been involved in many, many aspects of filmmaking. Which is the first role you had on set?
Sorry, I shouldn't have had that tea. Well, the first thing I did was Stanley employed me as a location photographer because when I was 16, he gave me his nickel mat and taught me how to take photographs and how to, you know, develop and print film and print pictures. So I was immediately, therefore, useful. So when we went to Ireland to make Barry Lyndon, he had this 19-year-old who was, you know, without anything to do. So he said, okay, well, you're going to go and look for locations. And at that point, I was at art college and was undecided about what I wanted to do, really. And then working with Ken Adam, who was the production designer on Barry Lyndon, and we had this huge art department that we set up at the Audrey Hotel in Waterford. Anyhow, so I became part of the team and I was given pages of script and maps and I got my car and traveled around Ireland. And then that also moved to England. But that actually decided me that working on movies in the art department was something I wanted to do. And that sort of started the ball rolling.
So it was Ken Adam. I mean, he won an Oscar, didn't he, for his production design on that film? Yeah. So, can you get a better introduction to a film, really, in the art department?
Exactly. And the thing is that, as you know, Stanley had already worked with Ken because on Doctor Strangelove, Stanley had seen Doctor No, was very impressed with the set, which was, you know, unbelievable, actually, in its sort of a daring and bold design. And Stanley knew that he had found a kindred spirit, really. So Barry Lyndon was his second film with Stanley. And he was a great, great guy to work with, actually. He was, you know, infinitely knowledgeable. So it was a good lesson, a good school.
Yeah. Well, we're doing a tribute episode on him and just the legacy of his James Bond films. And obviously Spy Who Loved Me, of course, he was involved with that. And I assume that's how you came to be involved with that film, that link with Ken and Stanley.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So what happened was, I'd done some work on Barry Lyndon, for a year. I was a location photographer and then did other things, went back to college, worked on other movies. And then I knew that he was starting this film, and I just sort of said, oh, could I bring my portfolio? And this is a long time ago. This is 1976. Women did not work in the art department then. I mean, it was pretty unheard of, really. And so, you know, I used my connections to get my foot in the door, and I took my bulging art school portfolio. And Ernie Archer, who had worked on 2001 as a draftsman, was his principal draftsman there, very talented guy. And he looked at my portfolio and he just said, yeah, you know, we can find a job for you. So I started, you know, a gopher, a tea maker. And because I could draw and because I'd been to art school, I was given all the really fun things to do. So it was, and I was on it for a year. A good job. It was a good job, but I had to get a union ticket. And in those days, you couldn't get a ticket without a job, and you couldn't get a job without a ticket. So you had to find somebody who was willing to pay you or employ you for some peanuts, and then ask people to support you in your bid to become a union member. And they had to, you know, you had to pay your dues and everything. So you had ACTT, and then you had NAPCE. So those two, and I was ACTT. So that was fun. But I got it in the end.
Which did you kind of work on first? Did you, because Stanley was involved, brought in with the lighting, wasn't he, as well, I believe?
This is a story that has blossomed.
Ah, right. Okay, here we go. Well,
this is a story that has blossomed. Okay, so the 007 stage was specifically built around the tank at Pinewood. And it was at that point the biggest silent stage in Europe. Do you know what I mean when I say silent stage?
Yeah.
I say you can't shoot sound. So sound stage are all the padded ones where it's very quiet and you can't hear outside. Silent stage is you can hear everything that's happening outside because there's no padding, so you can't shoot sound. That's why it's called silent stage. Anyhow, so one of my jobs was to photograph the process of it being built, and then can designed his sets, and we were in the art department. We were making models of the submarines and doing all that. So finally, this enormous set is built. And now he's thinking, well, how the heck am I going to light this thing? So because apparently the lighting cameraman wasn't sure, he said to me, can you get, you know, Sammy to come? And I went, okay. And anyway, so I said to Dad, because I was still living at home then, and I said to Dad, he said, you've got to be fucking kidding me. I'm not going to go on somebody else's set. You know, that's unheard of. It's unprofessional. I can't do it. And Ken pleaded. Anyway, so one Sunday, very quietly, when nobody was there, Dad went to see Ken, and they walked around this enormous set. And the way Ken had designed it, there were already lights as part of the set design. Practicals, they're called. And Stanley just came off. And Stanley just said, we'll use the practicals. Just use the lights that you've already designed into the set. And that was it. That was it.
Simple but effective.
Simple but effective. But, you know, Stanley wasn't a big, he did use film lights, obviously, but he preferred practicals. He preferred, you know, the lights that you've got on your table. So, you know, obviously he did use film lights when he had to, but he preferred not to if he could use what was in the room. So
Barry Lyndon obviously being a prime example of him using natural light
go.
And the,
there you go,
and the candle, I mean, light.
In Barry Lyndon there were scenes where obviously you had huge banks of lights outside the windows in whatever location we were working on, but then they were heavily filtered to produce, you know, daylight, sunlight, but the candles are a famous case in point, and they had candles specially made. They did endless camera tests with how many wicks do you need in a candle in order to give you the most light, and some of the candles had 3 and 4 wicks in them, and of course they burnt down very, very quickly and produced an enormous amount of heat, and everybody was sweating, but there you go.
So obviously you are used to being on the sets and being on, you know, surrounded by, you know, filmmakers and everything. So when you came onto things like, you know, A Spy Who Loved Me, which is a massive production, were you very much at ease because it was something that you'd always known, or were you still a little bit kind of, like you say, being, weren't very many women who were working those?
No, I mean, people were, you have to imagine you're a young woman and there are no women in your art department and you're Stanley Kubrick's daughter, and people want you to fail really badly. People are expecting you to mess up and they don't take you seriously. And because I'd been to art college, that was also sort of held against me because they thought, oh, you know, don't get above your station, young lady. kind of thing. Mm. But I was desperate to succeed and worked very hard. And Dad said, you know, get there first, leave last, wear a sack, you know, don't just work really, really hard. And but going to a film studio, walking onto a sound stage, I mean, the smell of a sound stage is like Chanel. It's wonderful. I love the smell. They have a sound stage has a very specific smell to it. And you've got all these great chains hanging down from the gantry. And it's just like, it's a place where magic is made. I mean, It's wonderful. I loved it. I wasn't nervous about being at a film studio. I was nervous about not being able to do my job properly.
What was the first set that you were on that you remember? Obviously, you visited your Stanley's set.
Dr. Strangelove.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so I've got a photograph of me and my mother sitting on the table in the war room. So I was about 7 or 8. Yeah. So.
Another incredibly iconic set.
Oh, it was amazing. And you had to, so I went after school. And so that stage that was in Shepperton Studios. And that was a great studio with this old building. It was a major, a lot of the studios were built over mansions or large houses that had space. So that was a fantastic old building with a black and white tiled floor and a balcony. And apparently it was haunted because some actress had, you know, committed suicide by jumping off the balcony. Anyway, it was just rife with wonderful stories. It was a great studio. And I think the Rolling Stones took it over at some stage. And I worked there many years later for a company called BBRK when I was working in commercials. And I worked with Jeff Kirkland. And we worked on Midnight Express together.
Yes, yeah. And what did he do with that film?
I was his personal assistant and I was in the art department. So he was the production designer. And so BBRK specialized in television commercials. So you had a lot of the people who started in commercials. So you had, you know, Ridley Scott and Adrian Lyne and Alan Parker, that generation of young filmmakers who all started off doing pack shots. So, you know, I worked on, you know, Tesco advert and a Cadbury Smash advert. But Alan Parker liked working with Jeff Kirkland. They had already worked on Bugsy Malone. And so when he was going to do Midnight Express, Jeffrey was his production designer and I was Jeffrey's assistant and we went to Malta.
Absolutely incredible. And you were a location photographer and a location researcher as well.
Well, it kind of comes hand in hand. If you're looking for locations, you have to know what kind of architecture, what period I've got dogs running around. What kind of period you're looking for, what kind of buildings on Barry Lyndon. It had to not be too late. Too early was okay. If you find a half-timbered house, but you couldn't be near a busy road, you know, they had to do places for the crew and all the vans and stuff. So it was, you know, we were looking for a country road. This is before CGI, so you couldn't just CGI stuff out or put a blue screen, you know, behind the road. So you had to find vast areas of countryside with no telegraph poles and no signs of modernity anywhere. So I did a lot of travel, got very good at reading Ordnance Survey maps.
Did you have to find the Overlook Hotel then?
The Overlook Hotel, no, I didn't look for that, but the Overlook Hotel was called the Timberline Lodge, and it's in Oregon. My uncle and Doug, sorry, my brain's working, the lighting cameraman, Dougie Milsom, and they went second unit, basically, to set up the lights at the Timberline Lodge in Oregon after snow, and they put big lights in some of the windows, and they drove through the snow and they filmed it. It was just the two of them. I didn't go there. For The Shining, I was sent off to look for... I went to Anchorage and I was to set up a second unit location for when Halloran comes back after he's heard Danny and he's coming back and he's landing a plane in the snow. And I was setting up second unit, looking for locations, looking for a proper garage in Anchorage. And the whole time I was there, it did the snow. So they took me back. But I also found things like Indian carpets. I went to Phoenix, Arizona, and I was looking for Indian tribal rugs because we'd been looking at books. And Dad said, well, you know, we've got magazines dealing with tribal art, American tribal art. And then he said, oh, well, go to this person, go to see this person, this expert. And I went, and I was in Scottsdale, Arizona. I met this lady who went to this incredibly fancy gallery. And of course, looking at these tribal rugs, which are now art, and they're hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I'm on the phone, and I said, Dad, they're not gonna, you have to buy these. This is art. You know, they're really expensive. Oh, shit, okay, anyway. So they were copied. And I think there was the set that burnt down only had one authentic tribal rug on it. So that was a shame, but.
So obviously the public perception of Stanley is obviously very different to what reality is. So what was he, obviously he's your father, but what was he like to work with, or rather work for? Did he sort of treat you just the same, or was the, because obviously it's very difficult, isn't it, when it's family?
It's, well, yeah, I mean, the same, but, you know, his sort of stock phrase was, you know, you either care or you don't, and you had to work, if anything, harder, because you can't get away with shit, because, you know, you're the boss's daughter, so you have to try extra hard. And I did stuff for him and looked for locations and bulk props, and I just knew that, you know, you had to cover yourself. So if you found a great location, he said, okay, shoot it, give me the master shot. So he could get it printed out and take it to a second unit director and say, shoot it from this angle. So I had to give him the master shot, but I also had to have, you know, 360 map coordinates and then zoom in on details. And so I knew what he wanted, basically show him everything, because he didn't know what he wanted until he saw it, because you don't know what's out there. So don't show me what you think you like, show me what there is, and then I'll choose, which is fair enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And you made a few appearances in front of the camera. fleeting appearance. What was that like to be on the other side?
Well, it's just a laugh, isn't it? I mean, you know, you're because I would hang around on set. So I had a nanosecond at the Chelsea drugstore in Clockwork Orange, mm-hmm. where I got to walk in, you know, which was actually called the Chelsea drugstore. I think it's a McDonald's now or something tragic. So that was cool. And then I suppose Barry Lyndon. So I was one of the daughters, and we were in the field dancing and with Captain Quinn. And then we were at the lunch table where Ryan throws the glass of water and we all get thrown out. And then the third time was on, Eyes Wide Shut. And what had happened was that my eldest son had a cycling accident, and he was completely grazed. And I was furious because he wasn't wearing his helmet, and he was completely grazed from top to bottom. And we were visiting my parents, and Dad said, oh, gee, you'd be a great patient for Dr. Bill, because you're all scabby and bleeding. But of course, by the time they got around to shooting that scene, Alex was all healed, but he promised that he could do it. So it became glands. But the thing is, if that's not your job, if it's not something that you want to do, i.e. be an actress, you're not nervous because you don't really care, because it's just a bit of a laugh.
Stressing up.
The next week, I was taking my portfolio to somebody where I wanted to have a show of my paintings, and I was, you know, sweating. So it just depends on what's important to you.
You did a lot of work. Your artwork was used in Eyes Wide Shut. Well, I mentioned that film. They're incredible. They're absolutely amazing. We're looking at some of them soon. They're brilliant.
Mostly my... So when Dad was looking for what kind of an apartment that Harford should live in, and lots of, you know, every apartment in New York and every apartment in London was photographed. And then we're having a discussion and, you know, how should we design it? And Dad was talking to Mum, and he said, well, you know, you have nice taste. Let's just use this stuff. So literally... The Harford's apartment is basically all our furniture and paintings and the sofa and all the knickknacks and, you know, the lamps, some of the lamps I bought, but the vases, the candlesticks. I mean, basically, there was nothing to sit on at home because it was all on the set. And he just felt comfortable, and he felt it looked really, you know, nice.
And your mum's also a very accomplished painter as well.
She sure is. You should have a look at her website. Mm. Yeah, it's really good.
You've got your own website now as well, haven't you?
It's a bit rudimentary, but because I am so technically useless, but I've sort of got one of those ones that are supposed to be easy to put things together, but I'm rubbish, but I do have one now at last.
Because you left the film business, didn't you, to do this artwork and jewellery?
I left because I had children.
Yeah.
And the truth is, if you're working in the film industry, it's so hard to get a job in the art department that I knew I couldn't say, well, I'm sorry, I can't come in today because, you know, the sprog's got measles or something. So I just dedicated myself to raising them. And that's when I went back to painting. So.
And you're doing lots of jewellery, aren't you? Wearable art and things.
I do, yeah.
I look at the website.
Silversmith now. I'm trying that. So it's fun. I like working with metal, actually. Mm. So it's good. I have lots of nice shiny tools and hammers and saws and things. It's immensely satisfying.
As you say, does that take you back to Jaws' teeth and the metal cogs?
Yeah, getting back to the subject, actually, what happened was, so there's a line in character, that the guy who writes the script, and you've invented this character, and people don't realize, you know, that a line could cost $1 million, you know, on if you have to build it. So, but everybody in the art department was really busy, and Ivor Beddoes, who was the sketch artist, too busy, Ken was too busy, everybody was too busy, and they gave it to the junior, which was me.
Jaws, I'm assigning you the task of recovering the microfilm copy of the tracking system. Every person who even comes into contact with that microfilm is to be eliminated.
So I got the stills photographer to take a photograph of Richard Keel grimacing. And so then I did lots of sketches, lots of ideas, lots of overlays, and then came up with something I thought was useful and then or doable that he could put in his mouth. Because obviously you couldn't have anything sharp in there. And I worked on the basis of interlocking cogs. And so anyway, so I did this drawing, did an overlay over Richard's face and took it down to Cubby. And they said, yeah, we're going to
do that. Does that kind of get passed on to somebody else that actually physically makes it?
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't make them because that then went to a dental technician. Because Richard was a giant, literally a giant. Yeah. So his jaw was slightly different than anybody else's. And he hated wearing them. They were immensely uncomfortable. Mm. And the minute that, you know, the camera stopped rolling, he'd spit them out. But I've got a really nice card from him saying, you know, great design on the teeth. So that was sweet.
Very iconic, though, aren't they?
Well, I mean, they are, and everybody knows that character. But he was only in two films.
Yeah.
But it's like, was it Short Round, the little dwarf with the hat? He was called Short Round.
Oh, Odd Job.
Yeah, Odd Job.
Yeah.
So also, not in many of the movies. But so I had a very varied job, which was nice. I didn't know what I was going to be doing from one day to the next, apart from tea.
But they were used again, weren't they, the teeth for Moonraker? Is it the same?
He was in Moonraker. So he was in those two movies, Spy You Love Me and Moonraker. And I left Moonraker before the movie was finished because they'd kind of put me on back to where I was at the beginning. And I'd already done commercials and other movies in between. I just thought, well, I don't want to go back to the beginning. So I left and started to work on another film.
All right. So you did do some work on Moonraker.
Yeah, I was art department junior, you know, sticking photographs together and in the art department and tracing things. And you have a big drawing board and say, can you do this detail and do that detail? And then it's those drawings are then sent off to the carpentry shop or the plaster shop or whoever's making what you just drew up. So lots of responsibility.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if things had been different, what would, did you have like a goal within the art department that you were aiming for? Would it be production designer? You know,
I was going to be an Oscar-winning production designer.
Okay.
Oh.
Was. So, yeah. Well, you never know how your life's going to go, do you?
No.
So.
Yeah.
So. It is what it is. So there we are.
And you did quite a few other films as well. I'm a big fan of Supergirl. I know it's not everyone.
Oh, I loved working on that.
Yeah.
What is it?
The Burundi Wand. Pure, unadulterated evil. Ready?
What was that like? What did you do?
That was actually one of my favorite films to work on because I came in right at the beginning. They had literally just hired the production designer, and I was the first person that he hired. And he'd been working in America for a long time. He didn't know he had sort of lost contact with a lot of the English art department crew, and we worked very well together, and he gave me a lot of design freedom. So I was designing all kinds of things, furniture, eating utensils, those big pillows that they sit in.
Yeah, I remember.
Based on Klimt paintings, yeah. And I was sticking Klimt-esque big sheets together with this highly reflective material, because they were supposed to be, you know, in space on their own planet.
Yeah.
And can't remember the name of it. And so I did this big sample, and then that huge, it was a sort of 8x8 sample of Klimt-esque highly reflective plastic material, which then went to the drapes department, and then they had to reproduce it en masse to make these big things, cushions and sort of seats and things, and then tables and chairs and eating utensils and drinking stuff, and just a ton of fun things. I could just got to sit in my office and just draw things all day. It was wonderful. It was great. It was a really fun movie to work on. And then there was Selena the Witch.
Yeah, and Faye Dunaway.
And there was, yeah, she was really, it was Faye Dunaway, wasn't it?
Yeah,
she was
brilliant.
The Witch Tunnel. And then I got a chance to go in there and paint all the dripping skulls of blood and everything.
Yeah.
And I had my big pots of paint, and I was on the set with the lads, you know, with my big brushes painting all this stuff. So I had a whale of a time, actually. It was good.
And Dark Crystal as well. That's another film, yes, that sort of got more praise recently. They made a TV series off of it, don't they? But
I know. I didn't, yeah. I didn't see
it. I've not
that.
Seen it yet. No, no.
No, I was, I was on that for over a year, and started at EMI Studios, and I was on environment. And so we were making all the plants and models and mountains and modelling things. And I got moved, and I went up to Hampstead, and I was working at Henson's workshop up there.
Amazing.
On Downshire Hill, and so he lived across the street, and then I was put on to making jewellery for the Skeksis.
So
that was awesome. So you had all the model makers, who were working on Augra and the Pod people, so every creature had their own team of model makers, designers.
Wow.
Brian Froud was the overall creature designer, and Harry Lang was the sort of the production designer, and Harry Lang had worked on 2001, so we knew each other quite well. Yeah, it was just a great time. I mean, there was just so many interesting things going on, and I remember when I saw the movie, I was a bit disappointed, and it was a bit dark, and you didn't see half the detail of the stuff that we put. I mean, literally every costume was hand dyed and hand stitched, and you just didn't read on the screen. It was a shame, really. But
might be better on Blu-ray. I don't know, I've not checked.
Possibly.
Yeah,
they had an exhibition, or they do have a permanent running exhibition at MoMA, which is a museum of the modern moving image in Brooklyn, because I was there January 2020 because they were opening up the 2001 exhibition from the traveling Stanley Kubrick exhibition. Mm-hmm. And they had a huge Dark Crystal exhibition there with a lot of the original puppets and things, so that was, it was really interesting to revisit some of those guys.
Do you have anything, any little bits or bobs from the film sets that you've worked on? Have you managed to keep anything?
I do, but you're not supposed to.
Oh, right.
Not seeing it there in the background.
I tell you what I did do, though, is the other days I bought one of these.
Oh, yes, I've got, yeah. Baby Yoda, yeah. Bless him.
I absolutely love the Mandalorian.
They're lovely.
And every time I see these films, I just think, oh God, that would have been such fun to work on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially with Netflix, there's so many of those series, aren't there, that they're using more creative effects as well.
Exactly. Exactly. I quite like Sweet Tooth. I thought that was fun.
No, I've not seen
it. I haven't seen that one, though.
So many things you've got to watch.
But so many movies, so little time.
I know. Even in lockdown.
You know, sort of taking us back to sort of Bond. Was there any, have you managed to keep up with that series? Obviously, it's very long. We're in its 60th year now. Have you managed to keep up with watching the latest incarnations?
Yeah, I think I've seen just about all of them. I've seen the last one. I think I might have to watch it again, though. Didn't quite gel with me.
The latest one on the cinema.
Yeah. I need to give it a second shot. Sometimes if I see a movie and I'm not quite sure, I was in the wrong mood to watch it, I think, okay, well, I'll watch it again. I have to do that with quite a lot of movies. If I just sort of, it's not that I didn't get it. I was just, you know how you're in the wrong mood sometimes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now I'm so old, I usually fall asleep halfway through a movie.
It's quite a long one.
I know the first half of so many films. It's just ridiculous. Yeah. But yeah, no, I think I've seen just about all of them. And now that they're all talking about who the next Bond's going to be. Mm. I thought Craig was really good. I did two with Roger Moore. Always liked Sean Connery. Wasn't too sure about the Australian. He only did one.
He should not be named. Yeah.
And I don't know who the next one's going to be. There's a lot of guessing and people are putting different names forward. I'm sure Barbara's choosing as we speak.
Oh, yeah. And it'll probably be someone we don't know and a surprise, won't it?
People have very strong opinions. You know, it shouldn't be a woman, for instance. Mm. And, you know, if you're going to be puritanical about it, then, or purist about it, then I can see. But if it's just, you know, they've left the original Fleming.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A long time ago. So.
Yeah, well, yeah, the spy who left me isn't exactly Fleming-esque, is it? No. You know, it doesn't take away, you know, I see them as very separate things. You know, obviously started off being influenced by the novels, and they always take bits from short stories or a scene from the novels. But, you know, Spy Love Me, which is possibly, you know, you could argue the most iconic Bond film, because it has so much that people remember, people identify without actually having seen it. You know, if you say Jaws, the first thing is obviously you think of the shark.
Yes.
Obviously it's not called Jaws, but, and then, you know, the character of Jaws from The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker. And you don't have to have seen any of that. It's so iconic, you know, Roger Moore skiing off the mountain is, you know, parachute.
Oh, yeah, that was really Roger who did that.
Well, yeah. Roger.
Roger. In fact, it was quite funny because they were looking for somebody to do that shot because, you know, it's all about the first, you know, the opening sequence is always very, very important, isn't it? And I remember we were sitting around the art department, we were having this big meeting and the director was there and he said, well, we found this complete nutcase who said that he will, you know, ski off a mountain with a parachute. And they go, okay, that sounds good. You know, it's just, the thing about filmmaking is it's so hard. It's so complicated. It's so expensive. But there's also a lot of brainstorming and, well, this doesn't work. So let's try that. And let's, you know, see what happens. There's a lot of spontaneity involved, and also if there's a mistake, if something goes wrong, you know, you have to deal with it because you can't often rebuild it. It's like when you're shooting, you've got a shooting schedule, you have stuff outside and you have rain cover, so you have to have a rain cover set, which is what it is. It's a standby set that you can go and film in if you're rained off, and it's just, you know, or if that set is closed or burns down or something happens to the actor, or there's so many different ways that it can go horribly wrong. Or you've shot the film, you've shot your sequence, and the next day, as you know, you have rushes in the States called dailies. And back in the day when they're using film, you know, you can get a scratch on the film, you can get a hair in the gate, you can get something else wrong, and you have to go and do it again. And that all you know, adds to it. I think people who are using digital now are so much, so much luckier because you don't have any of those issues.
Well, yeah, like you mentioned about The Mandalorian, they're having those virtual sets where, you know, the background, obviously, as the camera moves, and which is mind-blowing that they can do that. And obviously, you know, Stanley was very much at the fore of filmmaking and kind of, you know, was always pushing things, not only as a technically, but also as the form itself. Do you think he would have embraced things like virtual sets, or would he be more kind of, you want something physical? And obviously, as an actor, it's very different being on a you know, virtual set and or being in a, like you said, like with the apartment in Eyes Wide Shut. Do you think?
Sure. I mean, even on Spy Who Loved Me, we had blue screen or green screen when you're supposed to, when the set's supposed to be under the sea. You've got this sort of shark swimming by. I don't know how actors play to, you know, nothing, or to, you know, being afraid of a dinosaur that's not there. But I think that with the CGI and the technical advances in the last 20 years, I think Stanley was such a geek, he would have absolutely embraced it because, you know, it's famous he didn't like to travel. And, you know, to be able to do things and still sleep in his own bed at night was, you know, the ultimate you know, luxury and also something that most people would like to do. You know, that's having your life sorted, sleep at home, but, you know, still do what you want to do with your art. I think he would have loved working with digital. He loved film. He was a photographer first and foremost. Yeah. I remember going to visit him on the set at Luton Hoo when he was shooting Eyes Wide Shut, and they were shooting the party sequence. So Luton Hoo is a stately home just up the road from where I used to live, and with this beautiful staircase, and the rooms were all lit with Christmas lights, real Christmas lights. There were no film lights there. And so I just dropped the kids off. I've got three boys, and I dropped them off at school, and I thought, oh, I'll go and say hi. So I went up to Luton Hoo, and Daddy was in his trailer, and he was looking at the rushes from the day before of Nicole with her glass of champagne, putting her hand back on the table behind her, and then being chatted up by what's his name. And he said, oh, come and have a look at this. Come and have a look. This is so gorgeous. And so we're watching it on the steam bag, because he had a steam bag in his trailer. And he said, isn't it beautiful? Isn't it gorgeous? Just look at those colors. Isn't it, you know, lush? And he was so excited. And I just said, well, how did you do that? And he said, well, because I pushed the film. So you push it in the camera and you push it at the lab. So then you get that lovely, intense, grainy, sort of saturated color thing. He loved it. And I don't know whether he would be using digital cameras now. He might for expediency, because you don't have all the lab issues. But I think he would have missed using film. I do. I think he would have missed using, because he knew what to do with it. He knew how he could, you know, push it and mold it to what he wanted. He was definitely a painter in that way.
Yeah. And having these to hand doesn't mean you have to use them all the time. You know, it's like, you know, I think for things like, you hear filmmakers saying how, you know, being able to watch the playback there and then, and not have to wait for rushes for the film is like amazing. And obviously you had video playback, didn't you, but I think that virtual sets, I think, lend itself to certain things. I can understand, like say, if you wanted to go and, you know, have film virtually the other side of the world, but would you still have those Ken Adam sets anymore? You know, if everything was done in the computer, obviously you need someone to design it, but there's something about, it's something timeless, isn't there, about those
sets?
Yeah,
I think Ken, for instance, was on Barry Lyndon, he wanted to design the sets. But if you can imagine having built all those sets of all those locations, you couldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you walk into a church or to a large house or a small room, the ambience, the sound, the patina, you know, you can't create that. You know, it's like with rubble, you can't build rubble. He said it's really impossible, which is when they were at Becton and they just said, you know, can we, you know, we're going to blow this shit up, and they went, yeah, fine, do what you want. So now you've got real rubble.
Yeah.
And you, on Barry Lyndon, you've got real houses, you've got real paintings, really high ceilings, you've got the echoing, you've got the polished floors. You can't build that. If you're doing fantasy, then, you know, the world's your oyster, you can do that. But I think that he would have loved. I mean, so on 2001, he was using a Moviola to edit, you know, these tiny little green things. I've never seen one. It looks like a little sort of robot. But then he was using the Avid on Eyes Wide Shut, and he loved it. He loved not having to sit there with miles and miles and miles of celluloid hanging from all his little pegs. So he loved the freedom that gave him and the choice. I mean, he always had three or four Steenbecks all around him when he was editing Full Metal Jacket and Barry Lyndon, because that was his favorite part of the process. And I always liken it to, you know, an artist mixing up their colors.
Yeah.
So shooting the film is mixing up all your colors, but putting them on the canvas is the editing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his baby. He loved it. That was his favorite bit of doing it.
I suppose that's when you build it, that it starts, that's when it actually comes together. And then
you can,
and there's so many options as well. And I know obviously things like Eyes Wide Shut had a very long kind of production as well as post-production, you know, but there's so many options if you're filming and you've got that luxury. And I suppose that Stanley was a very lucky filmmaker in that he had this full support of a studio and,
yes,
in some respects, well, you know, that he was able to.
Exactly. I mean, he always considered that time was his biggest luxury, and that, you know, he had very small crews. And he would film the rehearsals. He said, people said, well, why do you take so many takes? And he said, well, I've got all these expensive actors, these expensive sets, and I've all these crews standing around. The film going through the camera is the cheapest part of all of this, you know? And so why not film it? Because sometimes when you choose actors because you know that they've got the goods, you know that they are going to be able to produce what you want them to do. And then, but if they're off guard or they're tired or they're just thinking that they're rehearsing, they might be a little bit more experimental. But if the camera's rolling, that's when you might get gold, you know? And I know that a lot of actors I spoke to who work with him said, you know, we never get this amount of time to explore the role. And it's not just learn your lines and, you know, that's and move on to the next one. We're really going to milk these characters for everything that they've got. And the other thing is people talk about all these takes and, you know, sometimes they didn't know their lines. Sometimes they were hungover. not Tom and Nicole, but, you know, they were, you know, consummate professionals. But, you know, I was certainly, you know, on sets of Stanley's where the guy whose scene it was that day was hungover and hadn't learned their lines. Yeah. And now you've got a crew standing there, you know. So
it's interesting how like this those kind of there are certain things that like say you talk about the public perception of Stanley that kind of stick, and you know, obviously multiple takes is one that a lot of people think of, but there's plenty of other filmmakers who would just do the same thing. But I don't know what it was about Stanley that
well, because it's a shtick, you know, they like to, you know, pin it onto themselves. Yeah. So and so did this and so and so did that. So and this was mean and so and so was, you know, screwing his actresses or, you know, would only, you know, hire actresses who would sleep with him, that kind of thing. So there's always a little something that they like to stick on you. And really, since Dad died, I've spent most of my time saying to people, you know, you've never been on a film set. You don't know what you're talking about. And people say, oh, you would say that, wouldn't you?
Mm.
Well, yes. You can not believe me if you don't want to. As I've had a stand-up argument with somebody who said that Daddy filmed the moon landings. And yeah. He said, well, you know, and they said, well, you don't know what your parents do when you go to bed at night. And I would say, well, no, you're absolutely right. But I also know that he wasn't, you know, criminal.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That he wasn't going to completely, you know, undervalue hundreds of thousands of people's efforts by getting somebody ridiculous. To the moon. Why would you do that? Yeah. Why would you do that? Anyway, I just say, well, you know, he was so picky, he had to shoot on location. So that's how I say it.
Well, you said he had the luxury of time, but on the Bond films, they do them like, at the time, they were churning them out every 2 years. So was it a bit more, you know, rambunctious on set? Was it like a bit more quick? Yeah.
Yeah, it was quicker. But it was still, I can't remember how long we shot on Spy Who Loved Me, but I was on the picture for a year. So honestly, I can't remember. My memory's so bad now. But, you know, it was a year from beginning to end. So let's say 6 months of that was filming. And then after, you know, the art department leaves and the crew, everybody goes home and you strike the set, then of course they've got the editing. A lot of films are edited while they're being filmed as well. And so that probably was a better, a quicker process. They were actually shooting the first Superman.
Yes,
at the same time with Dick Donner was directing it. And, you know, the one with Mr. Luthor and Christopher Reeves was, this is where I was in J Block in the art department at Pinewood Studios. And there was this long corridor where you had to go to the dressing rooms. And so some of the art department lads thought it would be hilarious to pretend that they were going to throw me off the roof. So we went upstairs and they had me by the arms and legs and they were going to throw me off the roof. And Christopher Reeves was walking back to his dressing room in his cape and tights. Superman, help me.
Yeah.
And he just, I wish I could. He was a lovely guy, actually. He was a sweetheart.
Bless. And he was good friends with Roger, I believe, as well.
Roger was a nice man. I really like Roger. Yeah. He was very easygoing. I mean, kind of what you see is what you got kind of thing. So he was pretty straightforward.
That's good to hear, isn't it? Because years and years on, and particularly when someone's died, you occasionally get these stories that come out, someone accusing them of not being the nicest person. But you're like, you weren't there, were you? You know,
no, bugger off. You weren't there. Yeah. You don't know what it was like. So, and people like, they prefer to hear bad stories about people than good stories. Okay. Yeah. So it's just more interesting. I think that in the newspaper business, if it bleeds, it leads. So, you know, I don't have any time for that. And things I read about other people and, you know, actors and performers that I read about in the film industry or most of it, I just think, yeah, that's just rubbish.
Yeah.
It's just rubbish. You know, it's 50%. I mean, there were stories about my father, that he would drive his car with a helmet on, or that he had a helicopter spray insecticide over the garden, or what else did they say? Oh, and Punch said he was crazy, that he was certifiably insane. Actually, he sued them for that.
Okay.
And then and then there was a guy who was impersonating him.
Yes.
Alan Conway.
Mm.
Conway by name, Conman by name.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. And then they made a film with Tony Fruend, Stanley's longtime assistant, wrote a story.
John Malkovich.
Colour Me Kubrick.
Oh, Colour Me Kubrick, yeah.
John Malkovich, yeah.
He was a real scumbag, actually. Mm. And I was very glad when that film came out, because I was worried that there were people actually wandering around the world thinking that they'd met Stanley and that that's who he was.
Yeah.
So when that film came out, I'm very glad that it wasn't really Stanley, because I took a phone call. I was at my house and I took a phone call from this guy saying, oh, I'm manager of such and such a band. And we spoke to Stanley yesterday, and we've cancelled our tour, and we're going to come to the studio to record our music. So I'm like, okay, how did you get this number? And no idea. Anyway, so I called my father, and I said, oh, this guy's just phoned me about this band, blah, blah, blah. I don't know anything about it. So he was, this Alan Conway guy, was literally coining it in because people didn't know what Stanley looked like.
Yeah.
And people wanted to believe, they wanted to believe that it was Danny. And we all said, we rounded up on Dad, right? And we said, look, you've got to say something. You know, you've got to, you know, it's your fault. You don't go to restaurants, so nobody knows what you look like. So it's your fault that this guy's getting away with murder. Not literally, but.
Dear me.
Stanley had seen Dr. No, that was just to see Ken Adams' work. Do you know if he was a fan of the series or had watched any others? Because
I'm sure he would have watched everything. I mean, Stanley was nothing but a film fan, a film geek, and he watched everything. And when he wasn't in production on the weekends, we would have films in cans coming down from Wardour Street, and we had projectors, and we would, you know, get some Chinese takeout and watch movies. So he saw everything.
I think there was someone who had compiled, like, his favourite films or something, or the films that he had passed comment. And like, I think White Men Can't Jump was quite high. And I love, in the same way that one of Terrence Malick's favourite films is Zoolander. I think, because this, again, they think that because you're making kind of, I don't know, maybe intellectual or kind of artistic films, that you're incapable of enjoying Zoolander or, you know, something very Dumb and Dumber, you know.
Well, That White Men Can't Jump actually sort of originated with me, because it was on television one time, and I said to Dad, oh, you know, he said, oh yeah, it's a good movie, you should watch it.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But you know, he wrote a fan letter to Bergman. He actually wrote a fan letter, and he got a fan letter back from Kurosawa from
amazing.
When 2001 came out. So, you know, they all talk to each other, all the directors, and Stanley was nothing. You know, he was a huge fan of Spielberg's. He loved Stevens' films and Bergman and and Fellini and Tarkovsky and all those guys. So he watched everything. He saw everything. And I don't know if you ever saw a TV series called Heimat. Did you ever see that? You should see it. And he watched it twice back to back. It was like 20 programs or something. And it was basically about a German village from sort of 1915 or something through to the end of the war. And he also liked Carlos Saura and Spanish movie. And he saw a film that he made which was not, I can't remember the name now. And a film came and they didn't have subtitles on it. And he watched it in Spanish and absolutely loved it. Blood Wedding, that's the one. And just thought it was completely brilliant. So I think if you're a fan of the art of film, it's like painters, go and see other painters, mm-hmm. like other paintings. And it's, you know, and musicians listen to other music. Why would an artist of film, which is a very unique art form, actually, because it encompasses so many other art forms. Mm. And I think Stanley said that actually editing was probably the newest art form, didn't exist before film existed, but it is very much an art in and of itself.
You mentioned Steven Spielberg. I'm obsessed with the film AI. I think it's an absolute masterpiece. Do you think Stanley would have loved it?
I think so. We were sitting around the table and we'd been looking at all these drawings and Chris Baker had been doing all these sketches and he'd photographed my youngest son thinking that he could play David maybe. And then he just said, you know what, I think I'm going to get Stephen to direct it. And we all went, oh my, okay. And he said, no, because I'm going to make it too dark. And it's more Stephen's ballpark, it's more in his sensibility. And so he was going to produce and Stephen was going to direct. He couldn't do it right away because Stephen was busy. And Stanley didn't want to do it right away because you remember the scene where you're looking for the blue fairy and the oceans have taken over and you've got all the buildings sticking out.
Yeah.
When he was thinking about doing it, CGI couldn't do water yet.
Right.
I hadn't got that far. CGI also couldn't do fur, like for Teddy. So was David going to be a robot boy, or was he going to be a CGI boy? And was Teddy going to be a real Teddy, moving Teddy, mechanical Teddy, or was he going to be a CGI? They couldn't do fur and they couldn't do water. And he said, you know what, I'm just going to wait until the technology catches up with how I want it to be. And I really liked it. I thought it looked gorgeous. I thought Jude Law was inspired casting, actually.
Yeah.
I thought it was perfect in that role. I think the last few minutes where they're explaining, probably you didn't need to do it. A lot of those people thought that the figures standing around, that they were robots. They didn't realize that they were computers.
Yeah, I thought they were aliens, some people, didn't they?
People thought that they were robots. And if you stood, they were all standing around in a circle, weren't they?
Yeah.
You could see the circuitry, blah, blah, blah. So they're sharing the information because David is the last robot that had met humans.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing, and the flesh fair, oh my God.
Yeah, that's inspiring.
Really upsetting. Yeah. It's really upsetting scene.
It's awful,
It's awful. I mean, she leaves David in the woods. I know. I mean, it's almost a kind of sort of Bambi for trauma.
Childhood trauma.
My brother Jonathan's a big fan of your father's, and one question he wanted to ask was, obviously, you know, people think, oh, Stanley wasn't very prolific. You know, it's a handful of films over a very long period of time. But he was quite prolific, wasn't he? Because he was writing all the time. There's quite a lot of unproduced screenplays. And I keep hearing, oh, this is potentially going to happen with this and that. Has there been any developments around that?
Yeah, he was sad that he didn't make more films. And in between films, he was, and even while he was working, he was reading. And of course, everybody who had a script sent it to him. He had, you know, piles and piles of scripts and books, and he would get people to read books for him and you know, give him the pricey. And he did a huge amount of work on Napoleon, which you are no doubt aware of. And the reason that wasn't made was because they brought out a Rod Steiger film called Waterloo, which bombed at the box office. And the studio said, you know, we're not going to give you the money to make this film. And my mother said, oh, it's just they audiences don't want to see people writing with feathers, is what she said. But I think subsequently, because Stanley had amassed the largest private collection of photography, photographs of artwork, and his famous card catalogue where you knew at any day any of the characters, what they were doing at any time during the period of history that he was dealing with. So something may yet come of it. Then he worked on Aryan Papers, which was a Second World War story about an aunt and her nephew. And it was cast, and we were doing costume fittings, and I took my kids out of school because we were all going to move to Holland. And then Spielberg brought out Schindler's List.
Right, yeah,
kind of pipped him to the post. It's not a race, it's not a competition, but he decided that he just didn't want to do it. And my mother said, and we could see that he was getting incredibly upset doing the research, incredibly upset, because he had all these books. I mean, you'd open one page in one of these books he was reading and you would cry. So I don't even know how he really wanted to do it. But I think my mother said she was really pleased when he packed it in, actually, because it was just so upsetting, overwhelming. And then there were other stories. There was Eric Brighteyes was a story that he was interested in. And then there was probably a whole bunch of other things that I didn't even know about that he was interested in. So, but he was constantly looking for a story that he would fall in love with. And it has to sustain you through reading it multiple times. Can I make this film? Is it possible? Can I get the money? How will we do it? Then you have to shoot it. You've got pre-production, production, editing. You have to be totally in love with that story throughout the entire process. Mm-hmm. And he said, I don't know why I fall in love with the stories. It's like, why do you fall in love with your wife? I don't know. You just do. So is what he said.
Yeah. The Bond family, it was a family as well, wasn't it? It's sort of, obviously, Cubby was there, now Barbara, and all the people have grown and grown throughout.
Mike Wilson,
risen the productions, yeah.
Mike Wilson was there, and then Tina, Barbara's younger sister, she was my assistant on the Bond.
Oh right, okay.
So there's a photograph of the two of us standing there on the 007 stage in front of the submarines. Harold Wilson opened the set, which was a big
He did. Yeah.
He was a big film fan, actually, and he did the film industry a lot of favors. He was very in favor of the industry as a whole and did everything he could to, I think, it make it favorable with taxes and stuff. So
yeah,
it was fun times. It all seems like, well, it's all a lifetime ago now. I mean, my son's about to be 37, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I'm about to be a mother-in-law and I'm about to be a granny. So in June I'm going to be a granny and I'm going to be a mother-in-law in July, so I'm ever so thrilled.
Thank you so much, Katharina. It's been wonderful.
Okay, we have been around the houses a bit. I'm sorry about
that. I mean,
it's perfect.
Yeah, it's who's a fascinating insight. There's so many stories I'm sure that you haven't told us, but
and I haven't even had any wine yet, so
well, there you go. Well,
for part two. Really.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.